you have to know who you are and what it is that you're putting forward and be very clear about what's your motivation.
Welcome to the Behind the Scenes podcast. This is Michael Golab. Today I'm talking to Joe Hall. Joe is the founder of Ghetto Film School. The award-winning nonprofit organization works to foster talent within communities of color, aiming to bring diversity to the notoriously white movie industry. We talk about the importance of community building, the significance of knowing who you are and clarifying your motivation, the important skill of learning how to learn, the dangers of not having a clear mission and vision statement, how you can't help anyone as long as you're judging them, the immense power of creative thinking and storytelling, the difference between people who are good at their job and people who are just good at interviews, the significance of owning your mistakes, the crucial skill of listening, the power of solitude, and so much more. With locations in New York City, Los Angeles, and London, GFS is the most elite and inclusive film academy in the world, equipping students for top universities and careers in creative industries through two tracks: an introductory education program for high school students and early career support for alumni and young professionals. Guest instructors include J.J. Abrams, Wes Anderson, Jim Jarmusch, Annette Bening, Baz Luhrmann, Halle Berry, Lucas Hedges, Spike Lee, Steve McQueen, Frida Pinto, Chris Tucker, and Matthew Vaughn, to name but a few. And now, I bring you Joe Hall. Hi, Joe.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Happy to be here.
What do you love the most about being a social worker and founder of the GFS, the Ghetto Film School?
For me, that kind of work, the results are very tangible. You know, I can see my work play out from the initial planning and collaboration that's involved with external partners and funders and donors, what have you. To realize, you know, the final goals and objectives, you know, completing certain tasks or projects that benefit others. For example, my neighbors when I was a South Bronx social worker, or the students, alumni, and even the partners involved with GFS here in New York, but also in LA and now London. So for me, it's very clear. It's not in isolation where I can't see the entire process. And I like that. To me, the way my work is structured is very practical, in the sense that in a simple way, it should be obvious if I'm doing things correctly in alignment with others along the way. When that's not happening, it's not like I don't see it immediately. It's very clear. So I like that, because, you know, at the end of the day, you can understand what your contribution has been when you hear about a result.
And is it the thing that, I mean, the thing that drives you the most, to see how young people who might not get the opportunity otherwise, that to see them flourish and to see how they put the things that they've learned into practice? Is that a big thing in what drives your work?
Well, selfishly, being around creative people, particularly young creative people, now more than ever feels like such a privilege. So I don't have the same kind of pessimism or dim view of the future that a lot of people have. And I think that's mostly because I'm around these young folks and I see how hard they work. I see the passion they have. I see how much they care. Increasingly not caring about themselves necessarily first and foremost as individual artists, but they're caring more and more. This, I don't know where we're at now, is it Generation Z or what have you, but teenagers now have this sense of a larger responsibility to the greater good or society or whatever you want to say. And they're much more proactive in seeing themselves as agents of change. And they really want that to be imbued in what they're making, what they're writing, what they're talking about. And that's very inspiring to be around that. So in that sense, I'm getting a lot of great things out of it. It's not ghetto film school helping this disadvantaged, at risk, whatever labels other people like to use, or, you know, they wouldn't otherwise have the chance. That, you know, they're coming to us with a lot of gifts and a lot of contributions. And so, yes, we're creating a platform where they can further themselves. We're creating opportunities that they didn't have. Oftentimes it's the right connection, getting them the right interview after they've been through our course or things like that. But it's a partnership in a sense of who's benefiting. I would say all the staff at GFS, if you were to ask them that question, they would weigh in with a similar kind of, you know, I feel like I'm getting just as much as what I'm contributing. And in that sense, it's always helpful to think of what we're building as community building and not necessarily just an isolated company.
It's wonderful that you say that you and all the other people who work for the GFS have a similar feeling of getting something, of getting as much as the kids are getting out of it. That's very powerful, I think.
Doesn't work for everyone. So I understand that there are educators and teachers who have a lot of experience. And so what their approach to that is they are bringing that expertise, right? And that is their contribution to these young people's lives. And I'm sure they have examples that they can point to and say, you know, look what I did for this person when they were 16 or something. That's not the long-term view of what Ghetto Film School is about. And part of that is just an understanding that in the creative sector, to build a creative life, you need a lot of help along the way. And particularly if you're coming from families where your parents or your relatives have not gone down that path, they still want to be supportive. They want to help you, but it's such a specific journey. Obviously, it's different for everyone, but there's so many choices that an artist or a creative person has to make along the way that are very different than progressing in other fields or industries. So if you have a community that you've entered into where you're 14 or 15 years old and you've sort of grown within that to the point where you're 31 and you've gotten a script that you think someone is actually going to want to buy, and now you have to figure out legal representation, right? You can come back into that community and doesn't even have to be asking me or the staff. You could be asking others, right? And that's an incredibly valuable thing that we're about. So it's not a course where you're with us for a couple of years. It's a, you know, something that you can access for many years.
Well, it's wonderful with the community thing, because you, whatever you do in life, you can't do it on your own anyway. So,
If we were training poets, we might not need that, right?
Yeah, but even poets need a kind of a support network in a way. Maybe less so than filmmakers.
Yeah, someone early on, an agent who I love. He told me early on that filmmaking was a collaborative industrial art form. And so there are some good things about that, because a lot of this is built out because it is a business, right? So becoming a poet that can sustain themselves is a whole different journey, right? Like you're building your own infrastructure oftentimes, you know? Whereas there are so many entry points into the film world that oftentimes doesn't pay a lot, but it pays something, and you can kind of, you know, cobble things together and take advantage of some of that fact that it is an industry.
Is there anything you find applicable from being a social worker and a founder in your daily life?
If I'm understanding the question, I don't have a separation of my personal life and my professional life. I think other folks do this, but for me, it's all one life. It's my life. And I understand that it's happening right now, that there's no afterlife. So it's not like this is my dress rehearsal for something later on. So with that, I live with a sense of urgency and an awareness that I think I apply to everything. So it's not like I'm pulling from my professional life into my personal life. So if I'm on vacation, the holiday, enjoying restful time with my friends and family, I'm also very clear and cognizant of how that is building my overall practice and purpose, right? It's energizing me. It's giving me these things. But I don't see them as separate. And I think other people, they have a job because it provides them money, but it's not what they're, how would I say? It's not what they're about, right? But for me, like the best projects and the work that you do are done with friends. You know, people you admire, people that you want to be around all the time. Some might see that as a negative because they like it to be separate, but I don't. And so, yeah, for me, it makes it all much more vital and exciting. Now, you know, I've done every shit job you can imagine, especially when I was younger, you know, like picking tobacco in the summer, you know, or graffiti removal, like with a big plastic, or being a garbage man on the back of a truck, you know. But since university, I've been lucky enough never to have taken a job that I didn't believe in the mission 100%, and the understanding that it would make me better in the long run. So, kind of like applied a sort of early life training I got in athletics, you know, that it was always like, it had to have a reason. But it was never like, I've never had to like work for just to get money to fund my professional life. You know what I mean? I can't do that because I don't have separate lives. And I, you know, I guess I'm fortunate in the sense that I don't really care about money in that way. I don't have children, right? So that would be different, right? Because they would depend on me for that. And so it's a big advantage not to have making money as your primary life motivation. And in that sense, I'm not applying things from work to my everyday life. It's, for me, it's all the same thing.
So it's a calling in your case as well, you'd say.
I guess that's a way to put it. In the States, I probably would stay away from a calling. To me, it has a kind of religious spiritual connotation. I don't know. Which, you know, listen, a lot of my favorite people are very religious. But I see it more now, again, with getting back to these teenagers that I'm seeing at Ghetto Film School now and in other places. They don't see a separation of personal life and professional life. They're seeing it as fully integrated, which, you know, probably happens more with artists just because that's such a an all-consuming kind of task and approach to one's life, but I think it's also because these models were created at a time where people didn't have this sense of needing to make that kind of contribution to the whole. So I'm seeing that more often, and even from kids coming like me from like a working class or a poor background, where normally you know you didn't think of your professional or job as having that sense of purpose, larger purpose.
What advice would you give to your younger self? What do you wish you would have known in your 20s, 30s?
Like, stop smoking right now. When you're younger, you just can kind of plow through anything. So I really wish, yeah, in my 20s, man, I really wish I was not smoking. I wasn't smoking all the time. Like, I don't think I ever smoked before like 5 o'clock. But yeah, when you stop, which is probably like in my early 30s, you realize like, oh, wow. like, this is what my body should feel like all the time. And you realize the damage it's done. But yeah, that would be my smoking, like, stop smoking now. If I could, yeah, if I could go back, I would write that in big letters on my mirror, wherever I was, in my first apartment or my dorm room or something. I don't know.
It's funny because when you're young, I mean, I think it probably applies to most people. You think that you're immortal, and then there comes a time when we realize, oh, this life is somehow going to end someday, and maybe that's a big change. And I read that quote somewhere. Someone said that, God, I'm probably going to get it wrong, but your first life is when you're just living from day to day, and your second life starts when you realize that this life is just going to end.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel that in a way it puts things into perspective and makes you waste less time.
A little bit more focus. Yeah. I mean, again, getting back to the ghetto film school sort of talent pool, there's a young man that is running our London operation, like literally leading it. And he just turned 20. And he's got this old soul kind of quality about him, but the focus is unbelievable. And I think to myself at that age, you know, I was in uni, so he's not even going to university, right? He's just getting into it and providing leadership and building like this new operation in London. But so he has this, what you're talking about, like this kind of like sort of I'm invincible quality, but it's not being applied recklessly. So there, I was a bit more reckless. Luckily I had sports and that kind of, you know, reined me in, but you know, I could go on and on about mistakes I made in those ages.
Because you've just expanded into London, right? With the Ghetto Film School.
That's correct.
Yeah.
We did a pilot project in 2017 in the summer. And we did it with 15 young people. Just wanted to see how our curriculum, how our practice and approach to things might work in the UK. And then we extended that for a year. We did a couple of other courses, brought the students for 2 weeks to live up at the National Film and Television School. Then we shot a thesis project in Los Angeles that they wrote and produced. And so that gave us enough information. And then the first group, first proper sort of official group, we would say, started this past summer with a very young staff led by the guy I just described. And again, you think about a focus and a quality to a kind of badass quality to open a program like that in a pandemic, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if quote unquote experienced people would have been able to do it. Maybe part of it is being naive, but I don't think so. I think part of it is young people today, man, they've got it. They've got so much going on that is really interesting. I mean, if I had time, I would want to study it, particularly the young people in London that I'm meeting. They're not like American young people that I've been working with the last 30 years. If I had time, I would love to really get into how that presents itself. What am I picking up on? Some of my American colleagues, when they come over to teach or to run different parts of the program.
What makes them different, do you think?
New York is a very international city, so is Los Angeles. London, to me, has a different kind of international in the sense that the immigration is also perhaps coming from the empire. And so I think that there's a certain, you know, I'll say a hustle. And I say that in a really positive way. There is a hustle that London immigrant community has that is really special. So that just to me lends this whole vitality. It's really palpable to me. in the young people. And at the same time, they have, for all its faults, that British schooling system, if you can get out of that without being entirely crushed, certainly like on the creative side of things, you are coming out of that with a certain way of thinking and an ability to think about things. So, you know, it might be cliched. We oftentimes, those of us from ghetto film school in the States, we think of the London folks as being a bit more mature, right? The young people in London. But, and in fact, I said, Tony, you know, running London was an old soul, right? Like so that's probably along that line of thinking.
But Tony's the executive director in London.
Tony Fernandez, correct.
Mm,
yeah. You know, who he himself, like his parents came from Portugal, not speaking the language. They both got jobs. You know, classic immigrant story. They worked very hard to provide a better life for their two children. But in the process, they also both become managers in this company. And so he has that kind of entrepreneurial immigrant training, you know. He's been around a kind of boss conversation his whole life. His parents come home from work and they're talking about, you know, supervising staff and supplies running out and whatever they're talking about. But I think overall, I do see there is a unique quality that I'm very, very interested in with the young people in London. And like I said, if I had more free time, I would love to just get into it and really figure it out and talk to more people about it. You know, I'm sure there's a lot I could learn from people that have been running NGOs and schools and things in London.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Actually, what would be your main advice to someone who'd like to succeed as, well, the founder of a successful charity or a social worker, or even as a filmmaker? What would you say to these people?
You have to know who you are. And that's just as simple as I can say it. There's a lot of confusion that manifests, and you see it in films, right? You see it in companies, you see it in projects and different things. You can literally feel and see the confusion. And so that's the biggest thing. You have to know who you are and what it is that you're putting forward, and be very clear about what's your motivation. To me, with my staff, I always come back to, like, what is the motivation here? What are we thinking that by doing this way, or changing this part of the project, doing, like, what do we see that manifesting? Now, schools don't train us to be this way, right? I would say that's true in the UK as well as the States. I think if schools and growing up taught us more about how we think rather than the content, people would have the space, the ability to do this kind of personal work without it being seen as extra, right? Or it wouldn't be therapy or anything that they might label it. You know, it would just be regular. You would understand who you are, how you think, how you learn, and then what was your real motivation for becoming a social worker, right? Or becoming a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Did you ever see this movie, Half Nelson?
No.
Half Nelson is Ryan Gosling, early Ryan Gosling, and I forget the woman, this young woman, she's brilliant in the movie too. But when I saw
Half
that
Nelson.
Yeah, when I saw that film, he is a young teacher in like a community like the South Bronx, let's say, right? He's got so many of his own problems, and I've seen so many people like this in the South Bronx, particularly from outside the community, particularly, let's say, if you're white, right? And the folks that you're working with in the South Bronx are Black and Latino, that there's an instant validation somehow that you are there giving back, right? You're automatically seen as good because you're doing something in a quote unquote bad place, right? That's been defined by others as a bad place. And the film is brilliant because you see that he's his confusion, and he does not really understand why he is there and the harm that he causes. You know, he's got all kinds of his own problems, but he's doing it under the cover of the fact that he's merely showing up as a school teacher in this community. You know, his family and others who kind of know that he's a fuck up in a way, he's not figured things out, but it's like he's doing a good thing now. This happens sometimes, people who go into the Peace Corps, right? They're just lost and they're trying to figure out, well, if I go do this thing, maybe I can be a good person. But we really would do much better to just give them tools early on in life to just be able to learn these things about yourself. And then you could make those decisions.
So it all ties to having a strong why.
I would say a strong so what. You say you want to do all this, so what? Like, what is it? You know, I had a boss early on in my career in the Bronx, and she, you know, when we would write grants, she'd say, you know, to get money from a foundation or government, you know, it was who, what, when, where, how. And then she would say, that all has to be in the proposal. The most important thing is so what? You know, what does all this really mean? Like, so what? Uh-huh. You say you're going to do all these things. You say you want to do all these things. But like, what does it really matter?
Like, yeah. It kind of, you know what? It reminds me of this question, because it's something that people often ask you is, what would you do if you couldn't fail? I've read something more interesting lately where someone said, what would you do even if you would fail?
Well.
It makes you think of what you really love, and what you where do you think you have to make a difference, even if you fail?
You see examples of this, of people who know they're going to fail, right? On some level, usually they're able to make that sacrifice. You know, I think of certain big movements, like early civil rights movement in the United States, right? Those people understood that was a long journey, which, to be honest, still hasn't been completed in this country. And they knew that people would get hurt and even killed along the way, right? They were smart enough to know that. And but you know, that movement was grounded in a spiritual component, which I think allows people to always to go that extra contribution, that extra work that you're describing.
Extra mile, yeah.
Because they know that it's not going to work, at least not right away.
But it's something that is bigger than them.
That is correct.
Which gives you, I think, immense power in a way, you know, whether it's spiritual or you call it, I don't know.
Yes, it is. You know, I would also say that martyrdom is somewhat overrated, because what happens is you lose that movement or that community loses with the martyr, that experience, that capacity, that knowledge, right? Like, that's gone. And oftentimes we can't fill it. So yes, symbolically over time, it could be that person represents something beyond themselves, right? Larger than themselves, and other people can access those points.
So how do you mentioned that you have to know who you are. How do you find out who you are?
You have to be asking about that, and people have to tell you. So, you know, you have to, again, I think for myself, my life really changed with athletics. And so those coaches, you know, some of that advice was just purely on how to be a better basketball player. But I was clear that if I listened to them, they cared about me. And so, you know, you have to have that trust. That there are people that certainly in my life have been incredible mentors to me. So, you know, you have to have access to those folks. And, you know, I'll come back to it again. Our education system is not structured that way to provide young people with really guidance and mentoring rather than, you know, memorize all this and we're going to have a test in 2 weeks and see if you remember it all.
And also what I find so problematic is that most of it is not non-applicable. So you just learn something and you learn it for the test, not for your life or for what you want to do. You just learn it because, you know, it's going to be part of the test.
Correct.
So it kind of teaches you all the wrong things to, like, learn something short term and to then forget it and to, you know, just to get a good grade but not care about the consequences of all of that. Mm.
In social work education, the education I had at Columbia University in the late 80s, early 90s, really focused a lot on teaching you to understand how you thought, right? How you learned, how you took in information.
Oh, wow.
If you did that and you had the right teachers, it also taught you your power in a way.
How did they do that? Is it through asking the right questions and letting you find the answers yourself? Or what was the process?
So in that program, 3 days a week, everyone was in a practicum. I was in a community center in the Bronx. One of the projects that they had me working on at this community center was a foster care prevention and reuniting with a local hospital. So you were trying to help mostly single women either not have their kids taken into foster care, right? Removed from their home. So you're trying to help them figure out services and supports that they can access to prevent that from happening, but also trying to help women whose children had been taken, right? To get them back. Which is really hard because the financial incentive of the whole system is to separate the kids from the parents. But you know, I was a student, so I wasn't really like involved in the counseling, but I was involved in data collection and things. And I had a conversation with one of the women once, and she had just had a miscarriage. And she said, you know, if I'm being honest, I'm kind of happy. And I said, oh, you know, I don't think I had an answer for her. And she said, yeah. She said, you know, it's just not going to work. And so I think it was like every 2 weeks, you had like a group session with your, at Columbia University, with your guidance person. I forget what the title was. And there were maybe like 10 of us in the group, 10 students. And I brought this up because I couldn't believe that someone would say that. You know, I was judging this this woman. And this professor at Columbia, Rini Solomon, brilliant teacher, took me through that process of like, if you're judging your client, right? In social work, you call them a client. If you're judging your client, you can never help them. Uh-huh. And that was a big thing for me to be able to understand that until I made that shift, I was going to be ineffective, right? You have to sort of look at yourself in that interaction. Uh-huh. You're not just the expert who's, you know, providing the resources, because social workers in certain communities have a lot of power because they are bringing access to a new apartment maybe, or, you know, I can help you get signed up for more food stamps, or like, it's, you know, these are real things.
So how'd you stop judging?
Well, maybe my competitive side in that example is I want to be effective. Like, I want to be really good. You know, anyone that knows me and works with me knows, like, I'm always trying to win. You know what I mean? Like, so that may sound counterintuitive to everything I just said, but like, it's just trying to get really good. It's like, again, maybe it's going back to being an athlete and just wanting to be like, being able not to judge. She explained to me, my professor at Columbia in those debrief sessions, that as long as I was judgmental, I couldn't be a really good social worker. So for me, I was like, oh, this means I'm getting stronger. I'm getting better. I'm going to be more effective. This is what I want to do for a living. So I want to be the very best I can.
It doesn't mean that at first it boils down to self-awareness. At first you're aware that you're judging, and because you're aware of it, then you can deal with it and stop like let go of it. Does it tie to that?
Yes, but most of the time, someone has to help you through that process, because if you've not done it before, you're not going to, you know, that social work education at Columbia, it was a 2-year program. I did an accelerated, you know, I did both summers as well. I thought, why didn't they teach me this when I was 12? Like, this is what I really should have been learning all along. That the content and the information, I can do that at any point. But if you had taught me at a very young age about how I think and how I take in information, right? So in social work school, I'm learning, I don't like a classroom or a group environment. I like mentors. I would go to my professor's office hours all the time. Other people never went because I liked that kind of one-on-one rapport, you know, but I was learning that about myself. And if I had known that when I was 12, you know, that probably would have been a lot more influential in my formative years as a student than just as a young kid, rather than, you know, memorizing US history because it's going to be on an exam at the end of the term.
Do you reckon that there's a way to acquire these skills without having the right mentors in your life?
Not for me. I have a sister-in-law.
Yeah.
She really values the written word. She gets everything useful on these kind of things. The information that she likes the most, that has the most usefulness for her, maybe even the most valid in a way, comes from books. She's incredibly well read. She's also a social person. You know, she's fantastic, but she places great importance in, you know, if you wrote this down, it took you a while, someone made a decision to publish it, you know, I have it now in my hand. That's what she likes. Me, I don't read as much as I should. You know, if there was one thing I could improve, it would be reading a bit more. But I watch a lot of things. I watch a lot of content and things, and not all of it is trashy reality television.
Do you have a letting go ritual? Is there anything you do to find peace at the end of a stressful day?
For me, some solitude is always very helpful. Certainly not during the pandemic, but normally my daily life is filled with a lot of people and a lot of interaction. And so solitude is vital for me. That's when I recharge. If I'm on holiday, if I'm, you know, on an away trip with a lover or something, like there are points where I just have to be by myself. And so that's always kind of refreshing for me.
But that kind of ties to that thing you talked about before about finding out who you are. Because if there's constant noise, be it conversations or watching something or even reading a good book, if you don't then go away and like think about it or just be, I don't know, be it in nature or wherever you are, then these things kind of you don't go as deep, I guess.
Yeah.
So solitude's a big thing, I think, yeah. I mean, not to be scared of it.
It's also part of my training. So when I was little, on the weekends, you had to be out of the house before noon and you didn't come back until dinner time, 6:30. So that whole time you had to figure out stuff, right? And some of that I would be by myself. You can't do that now. Now, every hour of the day for an American child is super structured and parents and adults are always around. Me, I could be, you know, with my friends on a bike and we'd be, you know, riding bikes over to this park that was far away from my where I lived. You know, we could be by ourselves. I could, you know, be doing anything in a junkyard. We would find things. We would build things. We would, you know, now that would be really frowned upon, I think. We'd go climb trees. My niece told me that some of her neighbors like called the authorities because they saw her son climbing the tree in her backyard.
Wow.
That was dangerous. So, you know, they call it helicopter parents, you know, like, so part of that is probably just my training of being alone was fine. Most of the time I was with my friends, right? We'd play basketball. We had a community center that we could go to. There were adults there, but we did stuff on our own. We built tree forts. We'd ride our bikes to the woods. You know, our neighborhood didn't really have a lot of woods, but we'd build stuff.
Yeah.
And some of that was tough, but other, you know, some people were clearly like leading the process, you know, whereas I guess if there were adult supervision folks involved, you know, maybe there would be more sharing or what have you. So I'm not saying it always worked when we designed the rules ourselves and all that, but being alone, I don't think was seen as problematic. Is my parents were just like, you just have to get out of this house, like get out of here, like you could not be in your house. And that was true of all my neighbors.
What would you say are the greatest mistakes that people make when running a nonprofit organization?
There's no clear mission. If you really don't know why you exist, or you're not, I mean, just go on these websites and read some of these mission statements. A, they're not mission statements, first of all. So they're confusing just even grammatically. And as, you know, as some text, they're confusing. So you don't know what you're doing or what you're about. And then that oftentimes can lead to you're chasing the money. And then one day you wake up and you have no idea what this organization is anymore that you're ostensibly leading. So, you know, Ghetto Film School's mission statement is to educate, develop, and celebrate the next generation of great storytellers. All carefully chosen words, slightly audacious, right? Which a good mission statement should be a stretch. It should be, but it's not saying how we do things. It's sort of putting out there what we are expecting to achieve, you know, and what we're going to be doing and what we're going to be about. Before we opened in London, it used to be the next generation of great American storytellers with a capital A. And some people had problems with that. And we, again, I think intentionally, we were very clear that we didn't see our student body as being non-traditional, or I'm trying to think of some other language that people would use, at risk, disadvantaged. We were like, no, they are the mainstream. And that's exactly how we're approaching this. So the other problem, depending on who you're working with in the nonprofit sector, I've seen websites for organizations that are ostensibly are teaching teenagers art. And on the website, it'll say, our participants have 50% lower rates of obesity than their peers. I don't know what any of that has to do with being an artist or drawing. And so those kind of organizations, they probably got some money from like the Department of Health, right? And they framed what they were doing as like arts therapy, or I don't know, in this case, like art weight loss. I don't know what, but to me, that's all confusing. So, you know,
to be clear.
Yeah. But, and I've suffered from this from time to time, and you have to check yourself. And hopefully, again, you have a board and mentors and people, you know, you need those folks throughout your entire career. That there is a sense of entitlement a lot in the nonprofit sector, right? So the fact that I'm here doing whatever and society is so messed up, we should be, you know, getting money. Or, you know, doing whatever we're allowed to do. And that's not true, nor should it be true. So, but I would say the number one thing is just a lack of a clear mission and vision. You'd be amazed. You can go into organizations like these and ask 10 people what's the mission and get 10 different takes on what it is that they're actually there to do. And in Ghetto Film School, we probably spend way more time talking about these things than other places would deem necessary.
That's so interesting. That's so interesting. I'm thinking about, you know, storytelling when you're shooting a movie or when you're putting on a piece of theater. Everyone has to be clear about what the play is about or what the film's about. Otherwise, like you said, it all falls apart. So I think it ties to everything, to life and to good storytelling as well.
Yeah, and just like a film needs a director that knows what she's doing, right?
Yeah.
And what she's looking to get out of this scene, this section, this film, whatever. Nonprofits, any company, any organization, you need leadership.
Why is it actually important to keep creating, well, good films, good theater, story? Why is storytelling important? And why is it important to keep giving children, young adults, these opportunities?
I mean, storytelling is an essential tool of power. So I would even start with social structures, political structures, the haves and the have-nots, a lot of things that affect everyone's daily life have been shaped over time by stories. And, you know, what's the saying, the winner writes history?
Yeah.
If the winner is also a good storyteller, they are going to write a history that has a whole different legacy, a whole different impact.
Oh, yeah. They call it the survivorship bias.
That's correct. That's correct. Mm. So just on a fundamental level, storytelling, because we are human beings, because we have memory, because we have ego, which can lead to aspirations and all these other things, stories drive a lot of human interaction. So if you know how to tell a strong, persuasive story, you are going to have more power than others. Now, yes, some people are born into power. They by association, their father is the president or whatever, or they're born into money. But, you know, so there are some other factors, obviously, that impact power. But yeah, if you, things being equal in certain segments, if you can tell a powerful story, you can persuade people. That's huge. That's a big thing.
So you're saying it means that giving people who are not born into power the opportunity or giving them the power, basically.
It could.
Yeah.
I do think that when you're coming from certain traditions, certain backgrounds, whether that's class, other ways, you're getting more of that. I had someone explain to me, I don't know if it's entirely true, but that movie about Mark Zuckerberg, right?
Social Network,
right? David Fincher. What someone explained to me is that the community he grew up in, which I believe was like Suffolk County out in Long Island, so, you know, probably a well-funded school district, that they actually had a very good arts program, you know, throughout his formative years. When you think about that movie, he's not inventing any technology at Harvard. Later on, he will, you know, he'll evolve the technology. But the really important decisions that he makes is about the storytelling and the aesthetics. Remember, he doesn't want ads. He wants a clean design, right? He makes all these decisions that is really what separates it, at least in its nascent stage, from the ones that have pop-up ads. Remember, he said, I want exclusive. I don't want pop-up ads. I want this to feel special, and this is how we're going to do it. And it's not about the technology. It's about the story and the aesthetics and everything that's created. So if you get a training like Ghetto Film School at a relatively young age, I think those skills are going to apply to all kinds of things. Mm. You know, you don't have to go on to be a filmmaker. We have graduates who have gone on to start their own nonprofits, or they work for a politician, or so I would expect that the brochures or the flyers coming out of that politician's office or their Instagram page, if someone that was trained, like the training we have, it should look a little bit better than someone who hasn't. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
But
I'm sure it will be.
One of the foundational texts of Ghetto Film School is A Whole New Mind by a business writer named Daniel Pink.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He's a great writer.
And he talks about in advanced economies, right? Europe, the States, that in the 21st century, you need to have creative abilities, skills, and training, because those jobs that you're currently thinking about will not exist. So all the back office operation of big law firms, I'm told it's even happening now, are in English speaking places like India, Philippines, where you can get highly trained people for little or no money. And because of technology, we can do it all over the T3 of the internet, right? Years ago, I had a MRI done at Columbia Presbyterian. I talked to my neurologist, he shows me the report, and I looked, the test is conducted by, it was a really long name. I said, oh, do you think this is an Indian name? Like so long. And he goes, oh yeah, he's Indian. And I said, oh yeah, you probably have like people coming here for Columbia for like training. He goes, no, he's in India. So they took the MRI here in New York, sent the images to India, where a neurologist in India who's probably making, you know, $40,000 a year or something, he created the initial report that then goes back to my neurologist. So my neurologist, his strengths have to be, he has to know all of this stuff, but his strength has to be on the customer service, if you will, right? The bedside manner. His strength has to be presenting his practice in a way that gets people, you know, to come. So he needs these skills in the same way that Mark Zuckerberg needed those skills. But you're not going to have accounting jobs in the United States. You'll have accountants, but very few of them. And what they'll be really good at is having people in a back office in the Philippines doing the work, but they will have the skills to tell a story, sell themselves in the business, create the aesthetics that when you go on their website, oh, this all looks amazing. We should have an account with these people.
It's weird, this whole outsourcing thing, isn't it?
I don't know if it's necessarily bad, but what you're seeing in the United States is people are realizing A, that it's happening, and B, that they've not been prepared for it, right? This is where the anger of the Trump universe.
Oh yeah.
You know, this is a match to that stuff. Now, they're also grounded in white supremacy. And so that's always existed from day one of this country, even precedes the, you know, founding of the country here. So it's a combination. But these folks understand that they had I don't think a lot of the Trump supporters statistically went to university, but they understand their high school education, if they graduated high school, did not prepare them for the economic reality of this country.
Mm.
So in some ways, I think Ghetto Film School, training people to make movies at a young age, is actually training them for a lot of other things. Their whole mind, right? We think about the left brain, the right brain, which ones do you need more for certain things, but
Lateral thinking as well.
Yeah, but that Daniel Pink book, you need to train people in in, again, getting back to what I was talking about earlier about like how they think, right? So it's problem solving. It's not memorization of content. Like,
Oh yeah, absolutely.
can you creatively solve a problem?
Yeah.
And that's what filmmaking is. You're problem solving all the time.
What's the title of the book again? The Daniel Pink book?
A Whole New Mind.
A Whole New Mind.
He's also got one called Drive that
Oh
all of our
yeah.
staff read about debunks some commonly held thoughts about motivation, human motivation,
Yeah,
where it comes
yeah.
from.
I read his other book, When, which is pretty good as well. It's about timing.
Now he's.
And To Sell as Human, where he I don't know if you know that one, where he talks about that we all sell, and that it's not about being a sleazy salesman, but like a good salesman who's not sleazy, and how to basically sell without being, yeah,
Which is
well,
storytelling.
which is storytelling. Yeah, well, you know, owning what you're selling and not being false. What is your greatest failure, and what did you learn from it?
I mean, I've made some big mistakes when I was younger, where I've hurt other people. So I would say, that would jump out at me first and foremost. Not quite sure what I learned from that, other than you shouldn't do those things, right? So,
Yeah.
and for me, it was once my life sort of got a bit realigned, and as a teenager, late teens, and then I'm sort of on a track where I felt like, all right, now I'm on a path to something, right? Like I'm in university, I'm getting things together. Then that changed. The other thing is, I would say professionally, I've made some really bad decisions on hiring. And one in particular that was such a massive project that we were doing, and the person that we put into that position, it had a lot of negative consequences. There is an essay by Malcolm Gladwell about in the National Football League, so not international football, right? Not soccer, but American football.
Yeah.
He talks about how the college football game is so different than the pro game that when you're drafting players from university, you can't really go by their success in college because it's apples and oranges. He then takes that example, which he lays out really well, as he oftentimes does, and then says it's the same thing in hiring staff. And I believe this is true. Some people are just great in interviews, right? They crush it. They're professional interviewers. They know how to give you the exact answer that you want to hear. They have references. People will tell you that how great they are. I mean, everyone exaggerates on resumes, but they make their resume like a certain way. So they're very good at maxing out on all the qualities and all the background material that you need to get a job. But it's been my experience, and reading this essay really helped me understand it, is that you don't really know who you've got until you're about 6 months, usually more, like 8 months maybe to a year, of like who you have.
Time will tell.
Yes, because someone will tell me very convincingly, yes, I'm a self-starter, I'm self-directed, and the references will tell you the same thing. And then you find this person waiting to be told what to do. Like, wait, you told us you were this thing. So all of that is true, but at the same time, I allowed that decision to go forward, and I should have been able to catch that. That was a big mistake.
Is there a way to filter through these things earlier on, do you reckon?
I should have listened more to other people in that moment who were weighing in quite loudly, I should say. And no matter how inclusive you are, and I would say, just from feedback we get, like a lot of people who work at the Ghetto Film School will tell you, like, they feel like they're hurt. But still, when you're the boss, when you're the founder, and people are telling you, like, I don't think she's right for this, you should really pay attention, because they're raising their hand to the boss and saying, oh, and I overrode that. I had a whole well thought out rationale for it, and didn't work. So I didn't see that as anyone else's mistake but my own. So in that regard, I'm honest with myself. Like, I own those things. And I'll tell people, yeah, I blew that badly. Because unless you do that, you're going to make the same mistake again, right?
Yeah. Like, pain plus reflection equals growth. That's a little algorithm I got from somewhere.
That sounds like something from Equinox Gym, like on the wall of the locker room. Like a picture of two amazingly hot people in like athletic gear that you can buy in the gift shop after you take your shower. I don't want pain. I agree with the other parts of that equation, but
the reflection part.
Yes, reflection is important. Pain, I would like to avoid if at all possible.
It's difficult though, isn't it? It's difficult to, because you can't really avoid pain in life. It's like part of the whole package.
If you're pushing yourself, there should be some things that go wrong. I mean, teenage years are incredibly difficult, right? You're not a child. You're not yet an adult. It's this weird in-between space. Your body's going through biological warfare, right? Insecurity abounds. And so I always try to have our staff and everyone remember that. And it's a painful time.
Oh, yeah.
At the same time, you're giving these teenagers this incredible range of tasks and responsibilities. And so I always say, like, the qualities you need to do what we're doing is you need a sense of humor, first and foremost. You know, we're not curing cancer, as they say. Let's be realistic. But the other thing is you need discretion, because over time, people in that community that you're building, right, into their early to mid 30s, right, everyone makes their worst, most horrible mistakes when they're teenagers. And you've got to understand that, because these kids are putting themselves out there, right? And they're going to make bad mistakes. So if you can deal with that with discretion, and they feel like, okay, that's being honored here, right? Not only did this mistake get me thrown out, I'm still here, but nobody's talking about it over and over and over again, right?
Yeah.
Because that's abusive. And discretion. We've all had teachers like that. You make a mistake, they talk about it too much. You forgot about the mistake, and then, like, 10 months later, you do something, and they say, well, Johnny, remember the time that you in front of everyone or something? It's a bad thing.
But these are people in my life as well, see, be it in school or in life, that I remember the most, where I felt that they always looked at you with new eyes every day. They gave you a chance. And it's a self-fulfilling belief that you, because they see you as someone better than you are, you do become that person.
Where did you go
better
to school?
Better than you are. Sorry?
Where did you go to school?
I went to school to Vienna.
Uh-huh. Would you say you were in particularly exceptional, amazing schools, or was this more Austrian?
Like, no, it was a good. I mean, it was
approach to education.
It was a good school, but it wasn't a private school. It was a public school. It was a good school. It was a tough school, but I had one teacher in particular who I felt like what we said before. He wasn't judging people. He wasn't judging people. He was just teaching us. He was truly passionate about the subject. He was actually my German and my English teacher. He was really passionate, and he'd just stay. He'd sacrifice all of his breaks to explain something to someone if they were interested.
That's right.
He was just really passionate about what he was teaching, and I feel like that this guy influenced me more than I realized, like his attitude. And I had a few people like that in my life where I was like, wow, this is just incredible, And even like you said, if you make mistakes, these people the next day they're still there for you. They don't make you feel like they want to get rid of you just because you messed up something.
Right.
Yeah. And that is such a gift, I think. In any relationship, really, in life, but especially as a teacher, you should have this ability to inspire people. by being inspired yourself, I guess.
Yeah, and that requires some level. Again, I can't speak to that experience in Vienna, but in the States, you would definitely need some realignment of systemic expectations and some core values to reward that. I mean, I had an amazing teacher in the fifth grade, and like every day involved art, food. We were literally making food in this classroom in a public school, and sports. She took us outside and we ran around and played games, and she structured things. And that wasn't what every class did, you know, in that school. You know, later on in my career, I found out she was probably had some kind of, she was from Greece. She probably had some like Montessori training, because it was very much the Montessori way. And, but she couldn't do that now. She wouldn't be allowed to have to have that kind of control over what she was doing with the students, because there would be, now you would have exams for the state for fifth graders, very high stakes, where, you know, the funding for my city's school system would depend on how many of us could, you know, do well on standard tests. So she couldn't.
Yeah. So the system's kind of the problem as well.
Yeah. But like she, you know, when we were like doing a week or two on Mexico, we were like making piñatas and
oh, wow,
making tacos and like just, or whatever she would do, you know, but it was like, she couldn't do that now because none of that translates into those standard exams. She was fantastic.
Cerebral and yeah.
Yeah, no, she was amazing. She had us outside too. She understood like at that age, your body, here's the combination of things you should have.
Yeah, you need to experience things.
Oh,
yeah.
She was an amazing teacher.
What are your plans for the future? What are the main things on your bucket list?
I'm really into football next, meaning soccer. So I'm trying to build out a platform to do some projects along that. I'm really intrigued. I would say the last 5 or 6 years, I've really gotten into football. I always used to watch the World Cup a little bit, but then I started watching, you know, your league in England, the Premier League. It comes on in the morning, on the weekends here, on NBC. So I, you know, I would watch it, and then I really got into it. And then doing Ghetto Film School, all the pre-planning and everything in England. England's such a soccer mad country, but. Just over half the world's population in 2018 stopped what they were doing to watch the World Cup.
Yeah.
So that is an incredible platform. And I would say, you know, you have to describe football as a huge cultural movement, right? Influence globally, like, I don't know, religion and music. I don't know what else, but like football is up there. So I'm into that.
Yeah. But is it again about giving people opportunities?
The thing sure.
Football and you?
Yeah. You know, here in the States, for some reason, this, the world's greatest sport, we, you know, we're getting better, but it's not available everywhere. And I'm interested in it. I'm interested also in the content design and execution. And so for me, I'm always trying to think like, what can I learn next? And I would like to get into creating content, whether that's merchandise, television, film for myself. So I think that's where I'm spending a lot of my time developing. And, you know, can't wait to get back to London. 'Cause right now I'm just remote with our staff in London and the students, but
you're in New York right now.
Yep.
Yep. By the way, would you like to tell our audience a story? Because you founded Ghetto Film School in 2000, right?
That's right.
The story with, because you're supported by all these massive Hollywood celebrities. The story with David O. Russell, who, I mean, people who might not know him, he's the director and writer of Joy, Silver Linings Playbook, American Hustle, among many others. How did you get him involved, and how did that happen?
at the time, Ghetto Film School was very small. It was just a summer program. So I had just started it. You know, I was floating it pretty much with my own funds, which are very limited. But I was doing it in the neighborhood where I lived and worked in the South Bronx. It's called Hunts Point. And my brother, who is a poet, I should say, was the writer in residence at Amherst College. So it's a very prestigious school. And one of his students volunteered for me that summer. A brilliant kid. So from very early on, Ghetto Film School, I had like 19 and 20 year olds teaching 15 year olds, you know what I mean? So it's always been kind of a young, again, getting back to that building a community type of vibe.
Yeah.
They had graduation that year and David was getting an honorary degree. So apparently at like they have senior week, they call it at Amherst College. And during that, the people that are getting the honorary degrees do like a workshop, right, that students can come to. So this young man that was working for me at the time, he went to this workshop and somehow at the beginning of this workshop, David finds out that down the hallway, one of the Supreme Court justices, Scalia, right, who's right wing, very famous, conservative jurist, I would say. And David decides, he stops the workshop he's doing and he gets the students that are with him and they go down the hall or whatever to this building and they bum rush Scalia's workshop. And famously in the front page of the Amherst College newspaper, they spell out this exchange where Scalia apparently yells to David, "You, sir, interrupting my workshop." And David yells back, "You, sir, interrupted my election," right? Because the Al Gore, George W. Bush election was in some ways decided by the Supreme Court, stopping the recount. So David ends up hanging out with a bunch of these students into the night, which is very much his style and personality, right? Very generous, but also a incredibly curious person. And he has a really great young vibe about him. It's one of the things I really love about him. He's just got a fresh take on things. And like I said, he's genuinely into people and curious about life, really. So he ends up hanging out with this guy. And then this kid says, "Hey, I work at this thing called Ghetto Film School," right? "Oh, that's a weird name. Where is this?" You know, and so when we meet back in New York, this young man says, "Look, I met David O. Russell. Look, I got his phone number." So I said, call him right now. We were in an office where I was doing, because back then I would do consulting jobs to make money to pay my rent. And then I was doing Ghetto Film School in the summer. So I said, "Call him right now." And he says, "What do I tell him?" And I said, "Just tell him we're going to be in LA," as if we go to LA from time to time. Of course, this is, you know, ridiculous. So David took the call, which was amazing. Like, "Hey, how are you?" David says, "Yeah, I'm around for like the next month. So if you guys come out, we should get together." And so we went to his house and we showed David a project that one of the kids had made. It was very fortuitous because that summer prior, we did something called the Sacred Stories Project. So we took students to like, maybe it was like 10 different faith traditions. So they went to a synagogue, they went to a Hindu temple out in Queens. They met with, what is this religion? It's like witches, Wiccan, right? Like, and they would hear some parables from that faith tradition. And then they wrote scripts and then shot their own little movie based on, you know, their interpretation or a modern day version of one of these stories. So the one that we showed David was actually a Buddhist story, based on a Buddhist story. And he was very close to Robert Thurman, probably still is, who's like basically like the leading American Buddhist, you know, like brought Buddhism. And I think Robert Thurman had taught at Amherst and was a mentor to David. So he knew about that kind of material. But then during this you know, this get together at his house, he says, you know, Joe, I should really be on your board. I could help you then. And, you know, you keep a straight face because there really is no board at that time. I mean, there is for legal purposes, right? You need a few people to form a legal entity, but it was like my friends and family board. So it's pretty extraordinary because this is early in David's career, but he's at that point, he's probably seen as an A-list director. Do you know what I mean? Like it was before I Heart Huckabees, but he had just finished Three Kings, right? Three Kings was a huge success, commercial success, critically acclaimed. So he was a big deal. And then the amazing thing about him in general is that he's very generous, especially about something that he's passionate about and he believes in. And so he started pulling in people, resources. He's been fantastic ever since.
And he's still on the board, right?
He's on the emeritus board, yes, with myself and some others. So, but still very much involved. He does classes, he does events, brings in, you know, big time people.
And well, finally, where can people find you? What is the best way to get in touch with you?
Well, I don't do social media at all. They could go to ghettofilm.org. There's an info thing and they could send me an email.
Any parting words, last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would say all the listeners should help you and this podcast and anyone else that has like a new passion project that's been launched during like the pandemic, because I think it's a great way to build community and support others during these incredibly difficult times. So, it's a good contribution to help others now more than ever.
I think it's all about inspiration, right? About listening to also different points of view. I find that is really helpful and expands your mind in a good way.
Totally.
Great. Thanks so much, Joe. That's been brilliant.
Excellent. Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
All right. Cheers.
Thank you for listening. If you find this podcast valuable, there are many ways you can support it. You can leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you happen to listen to it, and you can share it on social media. It really does help other listeners find us. And make sure to subscribe to get the next episode. Thanks so much for your support.